So I'm a little concerned that this period, or this stage two and stage three, is not going to be long enough. I may well be wrong, and if I'm wrong, and the stats at the end of the season, which will be July, August, show that they had none in these 92 games, or not very many, that might change people's thoughts on pre-season. They might say, well, okay, let's do a longer, lower intensity pre-season. Don't play these pre-season games.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Late Fitness Test. I'm your host, Del, and I'm joined by my co-host, Johnny Wilson. How are you doing, Johnny?
I'm doing great, thank you, Del. Fantastic week, enjoying the weather. I'm presenting a masterclass out in Iceland via webinar at the moment, which is really interesting. It's on the ankles, so we did our first day yesterday, which is awesome, and it's running for the next 4 weeks, so that's keeping me certainly very busy. And I am very excited about tonight's podcast because we have got a special guest and a very good friend of mine, and certainly somebody who I have looked up to in professional football for the last, I don't know how many years, 15 years. And certainly somebody I hugely respect, and I know we're going to get a brilliant podcast tonight.
There you go, and I'm glad you mentioned our guest. It's a gentleman who's been a physio for over 20 years, hung up his, what is it that you guys use? What's the term? Hung up. You can't say hung up your boots like a professional footballer does. What do you guys use? Hung up your medical bag? What is it?
Sponge bag.
Sponge bag, there you go. Hung up his sponge bag. It's Tony Flynn. How are you, Tony? You all right?
I'm very well, thanks, Del. I'm very well. Hello, Johnny. How are you?
Hi, Tony. How are you? Great to have you on the show tonight. Hanging up the sponge bag. I like that. I think we'll have to put that as the caption for the show. I like
hanging
that.
Up the sponge bag. There you go.
And
the,
I think it's different now. It was a sponge bag when I first started. It's a little different now, but I still had my bag, so I threw that away when I packed it in.
Magic spray, as they call it.
That's it. Yeah, that's it.
That's it. That's it. Well, thanks for joining us, Tony. Really appreciate it. Before we start, tell us a little bit about yourself and where you've been, because I know, as I said, you've been doing this for, well, you were doing this for about close to two decades, or over two decades.
Yeah, I played at a reasonable level, and then through the PFA, I retrained once I sort of was about ready to pack up playing. I did some coaching badges, but I wasn't really that keen on going down that route. So I retrained through physiotherapy for the PFA and also did a sports science degree with them. And I started at Leighton Orient. I did the youth team for a couple of years, and then I went into the first team and I stayed there quite a while. I stayed there probably, if I work it out now, probably about 10 years, maybe closer to 11. I then left there and went to what was Wimbledon, but it was basically in the throes of either folding up or moving to Milton Keynes, which it did, and I went up there with them, and I stayed there probably for 4 years. And then, as happens at that sort of time, a new manager came in, and he basically had a staff, and he didn't really. I was surplus to requirements, and I sort of saw that coming, so I got myself a job teaching in a higher education. And when I left there, Colchester United had just been promoted to the Championship, and they was looking for a physio because their physio left with the manager to go to Hull City, who was, I think, also in the Championship. I don't think they was in the Premier League, but I think they was in the Championship. And I spoke to Colchester there, and I said, well, look, I said, I'm pretty much settled in this job that I'm going to start in September in teaching. And they said, well, can you come and just help out? So I said, okay. I said, I'll do pre-season, and then I'll have a bit of time off and go teaching. And I stayed for nearly 15 years in the end. I was only supposed to do 6 weeks, but it's a good club. It's a good club, and I enjoyed it. And I just got to a point around about, I'm a little bit older than Johnny by a distance, and Johnny was very kind to me, because I would have to say that Johnny is one of the, probably a handful of physios that I also hugely respect and look up to. There's a lot of good physios around, but if I was to conclude a list, of the top three, Johnny would be certainly in there. Certainly in there.
Thank you, Tony.
Look at that. Well, Tony, let me ask you something. You were at Leighton Orient back in 96. That's when Tommy yes. Taylor was head coach or manager at the time. And you had the likes...
Who was that?
Tommy
was
Taylor.
That? That's right. Yes. Yeah.
Yep. So you had the likes of Peter Shilton there. You had Ray Wilkins. What was what was Wilkins like as a footballer and as a person?
He was Ray was obviously elderly then, but he was still an excellent footballer, and he was an absolute gentleman, an absolute gentleman. He came to us, and we was playing in the lowest level of professional football. He'd been at the highest level, World Cups, Manchester United, Chelsea, but was absolutely a gentleman. In his football work, he was a gentleman around the club to every person, the staff, the tea people, the young boys. He was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant. And I'll tell you a funny story, bless him. Ray, I always generally, and Johnny probably does the same, I always used to wait for the players to come off just to see if they're okay. And I'd be the last one up the tunnel, either at halftime or at the end. And we played a game. And we was quite a sort of an efficient team in Tommy was very good at, he knew what he wanted from certain individuals, and we played to that. And that sometimes was a little bit longer than probably Ray wanted to play, because Ray was, and I remember Ray from when I was a lot younger watching, he was a ball player, most certainly mm-hmm. a gifted ball player. So I wait for them all to come off, and Ray says to me, I think it's about time to retire, Tom. As we're walking up the tunnel, he says this. And I said, why is that, Ray? He said, because I've headed the ball more than I've kicked it. And it just made me chuckle. And I think not long after, he decided that that probably was the end of his playing career. And obviously, he went on to coach and manage, and unfortunately, passed away. But what a man. What a distinguished footballer, and certainly a distinguished man as well.
Yeah.
Absolute top man.
Yeah, I was talking to Paul Parker and Trevor Chalice, who both played alongside him, and Trevor played under him, and they had nothing but great things to say about Ray Wilkins. One of my favourite players growing up, anyway.
Yeah, I think you'd find it hard to get anyone to say a bad word about Ray. If you remember, I know people say these things when people die, but I think people genuinely meant it when they said that he was one of the good guys of football, and obviously was taken far too early. But yeah, he was certainly, he was only there, he wasn't there very long for us, really, not long enough. But interestingly enough, that period, like you said, we had Pete Shilton, who played for about four or five games, maybe six, seven. And we also had Alvin Martin. So we basically had three England, don't know whether Alvin captained England, but we had three England internationals in the short space of time at League Two, which is quite unusual, obviously.
Absolutely. And what about Tommy Taylor? I had him on the show a few weeks ago. Such a charismatic person. Has got some great stories, bags of experience. He's just come back from India. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, I worked for Tommy for a long time, and Tommy and I got on very well. Tommy was obviously an excellent footballer in his time. I mean, he played sort of 400 or 500 games in what was the first division then, which would be Premier League now. So he knew exactly what he wanted. I think sometimes Tommy would, by his own admission, probably not quite understand why people couldn't do what he could do. Because obviously he could do lots of things with a football that League Two footballers couldn't quite do. And we was relatively successful. We made two playoffs, and we had a couple of good cup runs. We couldn't quite get over the line with the two playoffs. We lost at the old Wembley. 1 year against Scunthorpe, and then we lost 2 years later at the Millennium Stadium against Blackpool, having taken the lead twice. So we just couldn't quite get over the line. But no, I really enjoyed working with Tommy. I really enjoyed his company as a person, his knowledge as a football man, and also his work ethic to run a team.
Brilliant. Johnny?
Tony, highlights of being a physio in professional football?
It's, as you well know, Johnny, it's a strange business. If we go to say some of the low things about it, is, you know, the amount of hours, probably less so now because you have more staff. But when you and I first started, it was basically And Gary Lewin tells me the same story. When he first started at Arsenal, he was probably the only medic there, really, and they was a big club at the time. And people probably, well, certainly, didn't give the resources to performance and medicine as they should have done. They would probably, as clubs, take a little bit away from the budget of the medicine and the performance and buy another player and things like that. So that would be one of the low sides of it, is the amount of time you had to commit to it. And it was all-encompassing, as you well know. Like, particularly if you go away, it's 24/7 for the period of time you're away. You're basically the only medical person they have access to. Now, it's different. You have doctors and chiropractors and all sorts at the big clubs. So the amount of time you have to commit to it, and both you and I did, and I got to an age now where I'm probably not prepared to do that anymore because of my age and the circumstances of I had some grandchildren that I was not getting to see. So, but the highlights, I think you'd probably agree with me that a good collective, a good band of footballers is good fun to be around. Generally, they work hard, and they work harder than people probably give them credit for. People sometimes say to me, well, they only work for 2 hours a day. Yeah, they do, but that's absolute high-intensity work. And nowadays, it's more than that because they'll have a rest and then they'll go in the gym for another hour. Probably not so much in the time I first started and probably when you did too. But the collection of a good team of individuals, and we did have that at Leighton Orient. We had a good team of individuals a number of times. I was there long enough for them to change a few teams around, and we had some really good boys and really good collection of players. And I think that's a highlight, really. If you can work with a gang of people that you respect for their work ethic and for their ability, because they can all play. We know they can play, otherwise they wouldn't be professionals. So, yeah, I had a lot of good times. I travelled with them. I mean, I've been with Leighton Orient. I went to Antigua for a pre-season tour. I went to Uganda. We went to a Ugandan, played a Ugandan national team for it might have been about 10 days. And it was just an eye-opener. And it was something that now, when I talk to my grandkids or whatever, and something about Africa, yeah, I've been there. And it was a different world, Johnny. Nicest people, got absolutely nothing, these people. We stayed in Kampala in a lovely hotel, absolutely lovely hotel. We come out of the hotel and we get probably 50 yards down the road and there's people that have got absolutely nothing. And it just shakes you. It shakes you because we're not used to that. There are people in England, obviously, or the UK that haven't got a lot, but there's a lot of people over there that didn't have anything. And that was a strange tour, absolute strange tour. We went and played the national team and had a good time, a good tour, really, a good experience, really. And Antigua as well, like I say, that was a good trip.
I know Uganda well. I went out there as a physio, Tony.
Did you?
Yeah, to help after. Well, like, because there was obviously the genocide out there, as you well know. So, I went out as a young physio to kind of help with regards to orthopedics, or, you know, kind of fitting prosthetic limbs and so on, right, and all that. But it was kind of a bigger experience than that for me because, you know, you were helping kind of, you know, school kids are doing a little bit of learning and this and that and a little bit of building. And, you know, so it was a very humbling experience for me as a person, you know, and it was... I can't explain it to you. I mean, I had another experience. I was in Tanzania. I had written this whole presentation on sport and exercise medicine, a scheme of work, a syllabus, and I'd gone out there for 6 days. This is only 2 years ago now, so it was in the off season, and I'd gone out there with Emi Ninja. So Emi is at Sheffield United now at the moment, and so he's up there with Jack Lester. And Emmy was at Hull at the time. So he had organised it, and I went out and I was doing a little bit with the Tanzanian national football team. So in the national hospital in Tanzania, in Dar es Salaam, what I did was I had this written out, this whole syllabus for sporting exercise medicine. I went into the hospital anyway, and there must have been 70 or 80 people just sitting down, doctors. They were from all, you can imagine, any type of background. And yeah. I put the first slide up, and they all looked at me as going like, no, we're not talking about this. And I realized that in the first few minutes, I had to turn the slideshow off, and we discussed football and medical matters and concussion and all that, just as a group of people who were so passionate about,
yeah.
like, Mr. John, but what would happen if you do this, you know? And it was, yeah. It was just beautiful. So I understand what you're saying there. And
yeah, Tony, it was exactly that. It was exactly that, Johnny. It was just, obviously, I'd travelled mostly around Europe and to America before that. But to go to Africa was a fantastic experience. And like I say, these people basically had nothing, but didn't expect anything, didn't want to trouble you or anything like that. But they was just solely nice people and football people. They wanted to, like you say, they wanted to learn about football from, obviously, a professional team in England, albeit the lowest level of professional. But no, good people, and it was a good experience. And the travel is a highlight. It can be hard work, as you well know. You go away for 7 days, and you're constantly training, and you basically end up doing the kit as well, because they don't take anybody because of the, so you're sort of between the staff, you're doing the bibs, the balls and everything, and the lads are just getting their rest when they can. But no, travelling, and like I say, the camaraderie of a good group of people, because you spend a lot of time with each other, travelling, staying away. So yeah, there's some highlights. Obviously the injuries can be a low. Sometimes you see some injuries that are significant, and it's very difficult for boys. I think that long-term injury boys probably don't get the care and attention, particularly at lower clubs, that they deserve, really, because of lack of resources.
Career-ending injuries, what have they looked like in your time in football? ACLs, well, ankle injuries?
I think I first... I'm trying to think what year I first come across. We had, funny enough, two ACLs in short succession, maybe 3 weeks apart. Both of them come back. One probably didn't play as high as he would have liked to. Both come back and played. But I think they was more likely to end an injury then. And I'm talking about 98, 99, when I first saw them. In my experience, then, more than now, Achilles ruptures. I don't think the two boys that had Achilles ruptures at that time probably never really fully recovered. I think it's a different technique now than it was then. And I don't think people actually give up. A lot of people talk about ACLs, and they become faddish, don't they? Yeah. ACL injuries become faddish maybe 10 years ago when they started repairing them, and everyone found out that they could come back from that. Achilles ruptures, and I believe that one of the Everton boys done these yesterday, didn't he? I believe one of them's got an Achilles injury that I noticed on the TV today that is going to be 6 months. So generally, if you've got an Achilles injury, that's probably a rupture or a partial rupture, I would guess. They are significant, as we know. I think less so now. I still think you have to be careful and protective of the lads. I know the last couple of ACLs I'd done, one of them certainly coincided when Ibrahimovic done his. And some manager said to me, oh, well, hold on, Ibrahimovic is back playing. Why is my boy? They did it at the same time. And I said, well, I'm not 100% sure why, and I gave him an answer as that Ibrahimovic probably took a chance because he was coming to the end of his career. He's won almost everything. So he knows that he cannot probably give it 15 months or 12 to 15 months because he's going to run out of time. And funny enough, he had a relapse. He was at Manchester United at the time. He had a relapse. So basically, he probably pushed it a little bit too hard. So I still think that even though the techniques now on ACLs and Achilles ruptures are much better and the prognosis is much better, I still think you have to be very wary and explain everything to the powers that be and to the player themselves. Because even when they come back, Johnny, you know, you've dealt with long-term significant injuries. These people take a time to get back to pre-event or pre-injury level. It's not just a case of getting back out there. It's a case of getting back to the level that they was at or they want to be at.
Yeah, a return to performance. There's a big difference between returning to performance and returning to play and returning to training. Because, you know, you're going to modify your behaviour. You're going to modify your risk-taking behaviour. And yeah. Until you actually kind of have the confidence, the redundancy with it, you know, psychologically to be able to kind of go, do you know what, I'm confident on this limb or I'm confident that I'm at the same risk as everybody else, then you're probably not going to perform at the same level, even though you're back squat training, even though maybe you've had some restricted minutes in game time. And then the return to play time frame will be written down as such. You know, you might be another 6 or 7 weeks before.
Absolutely.
You know,
and I'll give you an example of that, Johnny. I'll give you an example of that. Many years ago, probably 1980, I broke my leg when I was playing. And it was a relatively simple one. But I'd never, when I was getting back, it was a lengthy time. And interestingly enough, they put that, it was a lower leg, but they put it in a full length plaster cast. And I'm talking about 40 years ago. They put it in a full length plaster cast. So obviously you get the muscle wastage and the lack of proprioception and lack of movement in it when they do take the plaster cast off. And I was never very comfortable with it, even though I was back playing. And I went back to see the surgeon. And when I was talking to him, he said to me, "Do you know what?" He said, "It's a matter of building confidence," exactly like you've just said there, Johnny. He said, "And you're probably not going to be that confident until someone, without you knowing, gives you a belt on it. Gives you a belt on it right where," because I knew where the fracture site was, because obviously I'd seen the x-rays and everything, and I knew where the scars were and everything. And interestingly enough, my dad, who's no longer with us, used to come and watch me play all the time. And we were going home one night, and he said to me, "You know, remember that tackle that the boy got you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Was that near where you broke?" I said, "It was right on it, Dad." He said, "He told you that, didn't he?" He said, "He told you." And he said, "How did you feel about it?" I said, "Well, I'd have to say that it scared me when it happened. But 20 minutes later, I'm playing and I'm not even thinking about it." And he said, and my dad said to me, he said, "That surgeon said that." And you gain confidence from them sort of things. You know, when someone belts you on it, or with an ACL, you get yourself into the position that actually cause your injury, because they remember it. These boys, they know the mechanics of the injury when they get a significant one like that. It's like when people rupture Achilles, they basically inevitably look behind themselves to see who's kicked them, or the person near them hears a big snap. So they know the thing, and mine was the same. I gained a lot of confidence from the fact that he told me, the surgeon, that you'll get one on it and you'll forget all about it and you'll carry on, and you do, and that's like you say, with the longer term injuries. I mean, I had, when I was at Leighton Orient, Johnny, if I'm cut me short, if we're talking about something different, but I had a ruptured spleen. Not me, but a player. A player had a ruptured spleen.
How did that away.
Go on, Johnny, sorry.
How did that happen?
Well, it's really interesting. When you think to yourself a ruptured spleen, you're probably thinking it's got to be hit quite hard. Perhaps maybe in a car accident or something like that, something hits you there. He runs through this boy. We was away at York City. So it's a long way from Leighton Orient for someone to have that. This boy comes through and he tries to take a shot, and it's quite a weak shot. And as he has this shot, and he was a good footballer, he was a very good footballer, and it was unusual for him not to make a good contact with the ball. So he tries to get this shot away and he don't really get it fully. And as he wheels away to get back into his place, he basically runs into an opponent. But it wasn't a tackle because the ball's gone. It was just a collision of two fellas, not fantastically high speed, just a collision of two fellas. And he sort of stopped in his tracks for a few seconds, and then he went down onto his haunches, and then he gets up. But I'd already, you know yourself, Johnny, if you think something's a little bit, and you wonder why he's gone down like that, and you, you basically get to the side or whatever you call the ref. And so I go on, and he didn't look very well, although he was a bit perkier after I'd spoken to him. And he said that was a bit funny. He said, I don't know what happened there. So anyway, he comes off to the sidelines with me, and we're sort of looking. He said, I'm all right. So he goes back on, but I wasn't very comfortable. And I spoke to the referee as I went back on. I said, I'm going to stay here, ref. I said, because I'm not that comfortable. And what happened was, he goes back onto the field, but basically, he don't seem to be understanding where he's at and what he's needing to do, because he's just standing there. And the game's going on around him. And the ball come to him, and he just let it go past him. So I called the referee, and I said, look, I'm taking him off because he's not right. And you know yourself, you have a doctor at the thing. So anyway, the doctor looks at him, checked his blood pressure, checked a few things, and said, no, he's okay. So anyway, he's not going back on, and he stayed there. And then at the end of the match, the doctor looks at him again and said, yeah, he's okay. Anyway, on the route back, he's not very well. So he sat in the back, and he's probably trying to get a little sleep. And one of the lads shouted down to me, he'd been sick and this, that, and the other. So we diverted the coach into Pontefract Hospital. So I take him off, and they was very good that they let us get in quickly. And I said, can we do an ultrasound scan? Because they examined him, done the tests of his abdomen and everything. And they said, oh, no, he's fine. I said, could we just do a quick ultrasound just to see? And they said, no, he clinically don't warrant it. But anyway, by the time we get back to London, he's really poorly. And I then diverted the coach to the London Independent, you know, that one down in Beaumont Square.
Yeah.
And I'd already spoke to our club doc, who didn't travel with us, and he'd arranged for them to come in. And they basically removed his spleen that night.
Wow.
Because it was basically shattered. It was split into bits. I mean, he played maybe 6 months later, I believe, with, I don't know about now, but then he was taking some drugs for quite a long time for the spleen, really. But yeah, that was quite an unusual one. I mean, that would obviously, if I was to write a book on injuries, that goes there, because I wouldn't know how many ruptured spleens there's been in football, but it's probably not very many, is it, Johnny? There's very few people that have probably seen it.
Yeah, I mean, look, in if you look in rugby league and rugby union and Gaelic football, actually, you'll see some high collision tackles, and it'll be one of the things that there'll be a high clinical suspicion for will be a ruptured spleen. You know, like you would do in a car collision. But when it comes to professional football, it's like medial malleolar stress fractures. You don't really see them, and when you do see them, you go, "Wow, that's a bit unusual." So. I haven't come across one in football.
I mean, the interesting thing is, you're saying it's like a high impact sport of Gaelic and rugby union, rugby league, and although football can be, it's less so by a distance and less incidence of them high collisions. But this wasn't even one, so you had no suspicion of it because the collision was. It was obviously one of them just freaky ones. He's probably got himself into a position, but it wasn't like he got hit really hard, like a big forward in rugby would hit someone, Gaelic.
Did he have many complications then when he came back, Tony, being without a spleen? Because the spleen was removed, yeah?
Yes. Yeah. No, he didn't. He had some drugs, which I believe he had to take for 5 or 6 years. But no, he played. He played a long time after. Okay. And I mean, I don't know whether he gets any complications with it now. I've lost touch with him. He's moved up to Scotland, but he played for a while. He left. I don't know whether he left before me or I left, but I came against him as well because he came back to Colchester at that time later. So I did meet up with him again, and he carried on playing. So yeah.
Physios coming into professional football now, in the lower leagues, League Two, League One. Any tips or advice?
I think that one of the tips I would give a younger person coming into football is that I think at the lower end, because of the size of the squads and the resources of the club, they probably have to be prepared for two things. One, the manager wanting boys probably before they're ready. Not the boys ready, but before the physio's ready to release him back in. But not only that, I think they have to be prepared for the footballer themselves to try and cut a corner in terms of they want to play before they're probably ready as well. So whereas we know that we probably, this injury is probably 6 weeks with maybe 2 weeks fitness work, and in 8 weeks he's probably ready to fully train. The manager, certainly, and a lot of the boys, most of the boys, as you know, Johnny, a lot of them are driven individuals. The occasional one will probably take his time because he looks after himself, and rightly so, it's his body and it's his career. But I think that maybe one of the tips I would say is, look, be prepared for both people to be banging your head about when can I have him, when can I have him, or the player, when can I go back, when can I go back. And I think a lot of young people, particularly if they've done, say, their rotations in the hospitals or whatever, they probably are not ready for these driven individuals to want to get back as soon as they are. So that would be one of the tips. And also another tip I would say is that perhaps, and it's easier when you're older like you and I, is to filter things that the manager needs to know. These managers are busy. Now they get their director of football. So I always like to think that with you and I, we knew what to tell the manager. Listen, this boy is a serious risk. This boy will be okay. And we sort of live and die by our clinical judgments and our decisions, and we don't get all them right. And one day the manager will come to you and say, well, when you told me he was all right, well, okay, boss, I sort of held back that you had a niggle there that I thought he was going to be okay. And it's probably only a niggle, because if it was something that we was really worried about, we certainly wouldn't put him out there. So I think that another tip would be to just, you can't keep running to the manager with everything, because eventually he's going to get fed up with you, because he's reliant on you doing your job, and he's going to go out and do his, because he wouldn't be telling us about injuries, and we don't go and tell him out what team to pick for Saturday, because that's not our job.
I think that's a really important thing, is that if you're able to manage your own department, and that comes down to even stock ordering or managing the budget or just being in on time, you know, it's saying with regards to what time you want the injured players in. So if you think the gaffer wants them in at 8 o'clock in the morning, I would always say to the gaffer, I want them in at 7:45, because I want to know that I was managing my department. And if he was going to set standards, I was going to set higher standards. Yeah. And it was a case of, you know, I'm going to be in the club before you in the morning time, and I'm not leaving the club until you're gone, and I will manage this medical department, you know. And it was, and again, it's trying to kind of build relationships. Be a nice person. Listen very carefully. Listen carefully to the players. Listen carefully to the manager. Listen carefully to the fans, because, you know, it's their club, like, you know, this is what their family and their friends revolve around on a Saturday and a Tuesday. And I was always very respectful for that, you know, the people were paying good money to come on a Saturday and to watch these players play. And you know, and I would always take the time to say hello and whatever. Not that I'm anybody, I'm a nobody. I mean, I'm not any role model in professional football. But if any of the fans came and had a chat or anything like that, I would take the time to say how, you know, find out the name and so on and so forth. And I think kind of just maybe, you know, engrossing yourself in the culture of the club and being part of the club and, you know, as in kind of, you know, taking the time to say hello to everybody. And I always, you know, I like to start the morning off with a smile and a handshake. Obviously not now.
COVID,
you know, we wouldn't be doing that. But it kind of segues on nicely there, Tony. Tony, what are your thoughts on the restarting of the Premier League?
Well, that's interesting you say, Johnny, because currently I'm doing a little bit of compliance work, looking at the clubs doing their protocols for social distancing, hygiene, training. I mean, as you probably well know, and all the listeners will know, that they've now gone on to phase two, which is giving them some degree of contact football. And I'd have to say I've done three or four clubs over the last few days, and they've all been very good in what they've done. Now, obviously, these clubs, Premier League clubs, have got huge facilities and huge areas, and they've also to social distance, and they've also got some resources to back it up in terms of money. But they are doing very well. But with a caveat, and I've spoken to physios at all these clubs, and you'll know, Johnny, because you've done many, many pre-seasons, my concern, and maybe I should look up the injury rates of the German league that's just started back up. For 3 weeks they've been going, and I don't know what the injuries are. But my concern is that generally, anyone who's had 6 to 8 weeks off, which is what most of these Premier League boys have, and when I say they've had it off, Johnny, you know that they've been training, but they've been doing straight line running, a few sort of multi-directional drills, but that's on their own. And that's it's very difficult to push yourself to the level that you have to be at on your own. Biking, swimming, running, or even multi-directional running, it's very difficult. So now they're going to be back, and everybody knows that the start date for the first two games is the 17th. That's basically 19 days' time. Now, these boys are going to have to do an awful lot of intermittent high-intensity work, which is what football is, short, sharp sprints, a little relax, then a run backwards, then a jump, then a multi-directional run some other way, chasing a player back. They're going to have to do an awful lot of this, and then they're going to play on the 17th or the 19th a high-intensity Premier League game, one of the highest intense professional leagues in the world. I think it'll be less intense because it'll be behind closed doors, and it's very difficult to generate an atmosphere, but it will still be intense. Now, these boys, after 19 days training, having done a little bit previously in the last few weeks, but we both know that that's low sort of low intensity stuff, probably. Now, my concern is, and I think that perhaps, and I hope I'm not talking out of turn, I think that perhaps a lot of Premier League physios or medical directors are worried that we may get a spike. And I don't mean a spike of infection, because that's what they're worried about as well. I'm talking about a spike of muscle injuries, because they're not allowed to have friendlies. So the worst they're going to do, and you've seen 100 of them or maybe 1,000 of them, they're going to be having 11v11s at the training ground amongst themselves. And you know that intensity. Probably 15 years ago, I could have played in some of them myself, because the intensity is not like it should be. Because you've got boys that are not in the team, so they're fed up and moping. You've got boys that are in the team and know they're going to be in the team, so they're saving it for Saturday. So I'm a little concerned that this period, or this stage two and stage three, is not going to be long enough. I may well be wrong, and if I'm wrong, and the stats at the end of the season, which will be July, August, show that they had none in these 92 games, or not very many, that might change people's thoughts on pre-seasons. They might say, well, okay, let's do a longer, lower intensity pre-season. Don't play these pre-season games. Because you know yourself, Johnny, the clubs play 7, 8, 9 pre-season games, and they play 30 minutes for three teams, and then they'll play 2 45s. And maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just a little concerned that some of these high-speed athletes that are in the Premier League could end up with some hamstrings, some quads, calves, and things like that. So I am a little bit concerned about that. And only time will tell. And if, like I say, in August, the Premier League look at the data and they say, well, do you know what? In them 92 games, we had a significantly less muscle injuries than in the previous 7 months, maybe we'll have to rethink our sort of return to plays or our pre-season protocols.
I think it's a lot of food for thought there, Tony, and it it kind of comes back to that question of being able to tolerate the demands of professional football. And that's hard enough, given the fact that, you know, pre-season is what, six weeks? And that's tiny amount to try and condition anybody to be ready for the next 10 months. Yeah. And then you're trying to do that in half the time. So I think I would share your concerns there.
Because the interesting thing that you say about that, and you've probably seen it many times like I have, even when boys have done a full preseason, they've not been injured, they've played plenty of minutes in the preseason games, the first game of the season, they walk off and they say, Christ, I felt not right there. I felt tired towards the end. And even though they've done a whole preseason, they've done 5-6 preseason games with 30 minutes, then 45, then 70, then they'll have a couple of 90s. But they still, on the first game of the season, feel like they're not quite ready. And they won't be.
No, because you
can't. And these boys won't be. These boys won't be.
Can you, Tony? You can't replicate that real game intensity.
No, absolutely not. And that's the same with injuries, Johnny. We do so much work with them. We do all our balance work and our strength work and our proprioception and jumping and landing and all that. And then we'll do some high intensity stuff with them. But when they get into the group, and the group who are 6 months in advance of them in terms of physical work, they're blowing and they struggle. And then they think, oh, well, I'm a lot further back than I should be. Well, no, you are that because they've been playing and training all the time. And it's very difficult. And you know it's a precursor to injury. If you cannot cope with the demands, it's a precursor to injury.
Absolutely. Tony, it has been absolutely wonderful having you on the show this evening.
Very kind of you to invite me, Johnny.
We're honoured to have you on the show. We'd love to have you back again. I think that the listeners will have, you know, gleaned a load of information, especially with, you know, again, having a suspicion for spleen injuries, not always getting kind of distracted by the mechanism of injury. You know, so it doesn't always have to follow that classic textbook.
Yeah.
You know, so I've certainly learned loads on tonight's podcast. So thank you very much for that.
And, you're welcome.
You're a top man, absolute top man. Still, how did you find that for a podcast?
No, it's absolutely fantastic. And Tony, I've got one more question.
Go ahead.
Now, you guys have spoken in depth about, you know, return to play as a result of COVID, and we're talking, what, 9 weeks? How long has it been? Well, by the time they resume, it will be 9-10 weeks before the footballers last kick the ball.
Competitively.
So you're looking at 9-10 weeks without football. So they're saying that the season is going to end, well, the cup final is supposed to be the 1st of August, right? Season ends. And then they resume again on the 11th of September, which is another 5 or 6 weeks of basically pre-season. So how is that going to take its toll on the players' bodies?
Well, for me, I think that the issue with that will be that they'll probably be given maybe 2 weeks complete rest, and then they'll start, and they'll probably be okay because they will be, like Johnny has just discussed, they will be basically up to speed. And you will lose something in a 2 weeks complete rest, but these boys probably don't lose as much. I think what you'll find, the detrimental effects will be at the back end of next season.
Mm.
Because these boys, even though they've had a rest, a physical rest, as of these few weeks just gone, or these 6 weeks just gone, it's not like completely coming down when you know that you're going away on holiday and you're going to relax and you're going to lay on the beach or whatever. These boys, even though they've had all this time off, they've been preparing all the time for coming back because they knew that they was going to have to come back quite soon. So they've had the uncertainty of that. So they've had the physical rest of these last few weeks, but they haven't had the mental rest because they've had to stay tuned. And I think that at the back end of 21-22. Mm. At the back end of that, you will find there will be a certain amount of players that will be completely burnt out. Now, that then becomes an issue when they've then got to go on and play international football. Obviously, most of the boys I have worked with wouldn't have done that, but the Premier League boys will be then expected to go and play in the Euros, the Champions League next year, So they could actually be going right through and playing sort of with only a few weeks rest, almost the best part of 15 months.
Yeah, absolutely. And you got to take into consideration. Sorry, Johnny.
I was saying my heart goes out for the medical teams because they'll be just, you know, they wouldn't have had a break during this COVID period, you know, because they'll have, you know, so they'll have worked the whole way through this COVID period.
Well, I was talking to a number of them, Johnny, over these last few days, and you're absolutely right. They've been in because they've actually been instrumental in putting together these programs that the clubs are doing for social distancing because they're not allowed to do treatments now. Well, actually, it's changed now. They're allowed to do 15 minutes before and 15 minutes after because of the risk of infection. They have to wear PPE, which is completely alien to you and I to do any treatments, any manual therapy with an apron on or a mask on. It's just completely... But they have been in because they've been doing these protocols with the performance people and the administrators of the club. So they've been in all the time. And these boys are not going to get a break either because what they'll do, particularly if we go back to what we said about possible injuries in the 92-game season that's coming up, then they're going to have to deal with them for the few weeks that the rest of the people get the time off.
Crazy. Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, they need that 2 weeks off as well, you know.
Absolutely, 100%. But you know what it's like; they won't get it, Johnny. Particularly if you're in the head or you're in charge.
Yeah, you're not getting those 2 weeks, no.
No, exactly. And then you'll be burnt out, and people will wonder why you've not got the enthusiasm or the drive that you should have.
Yeah.
And they won't see it.
It takes us toll, time, Tony, and you can lose money and get it back. You can lose friends and get it back, but you can never get back time.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, no, and it's absolutely very precious. So you got to be careful.
Yeah, it is.
Great thank stuff. You. Thank you very much. Thank Cheers. You.
Johnny, it's a pleasure. Sam, thank you very much, young man.
Cheers, Tony. Appreciate it, mate. Have a good evening.
Yep. You take care, fellas.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
So, that was Tony Flynn, another fantastic podcast. Unfortunately, Big Ben wasn't here, but he was here in spirit. Let's wrap it up, Johnny. Twitter handle, my friend.
Johnny_Wilson5 at Twitter. And if you want to catch any of the stuff I do with regards to rehab or performance rehab or injury management, you can catch us on YouTube at Nottingham Physio.
Lovely. And have you had much feedback about the podcast the other night?
Yeah, the Harley Street podcast with Jarko Vudic. It was an excellent podcast, really. So if you are into hip and groin injuries and injury management and any managed surgically, we had a good discussion with Simon Marsh and Jarko Vudic with some really insightful questions from our international panel. So if you haven't already checked out the podcast for Harley Street, the podcast, then please check it out, guys. I'm sure Stel will leave a link to it in the show notes as well. So it was very, very interesting. Listen, I certainly learned loads and was very humbled to be part of that podcast.
Splendid. Well, that's it for another edition of the Late Fitness Test. We'll be back next week. Give us a follow on Twitter at Shoot Defence. We also have an Instagram page. So until next time, goodbye.